028 United States versus Marquez. Mr. Hankins, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is James Hankins. I'm from Edmond, Oklahoma, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Marquez. This case was one of these sprawling meth conspiracy cases out of New Mexico. 19 people were indicted. All of them pled out, except for Mr. Marquez. The central figure in the conspiracy was Mr. Christner, who passed away before trial. His actions loom large in the facts of this case. In our view, the government is going to have the most problem with two of the issues we raised. We believe in all of the issues we raised, but two in particular we believe pose some problems here. The first one is the count of possession with intent, possession of meth with intent. And this is actually what caused the most problem for Judge Brack in the Rule 29 motion, because the evidence supporting the conviction of Mr. Marquez of physically possessing methamphetamine with intention to distribute was a phone call. And that's it. No other corroborating evidence. Mr. Marquez was never seen with meth. No one, there was no controlled buy, as the DEA did with Mr. Christner, actually on a couple of occasions with him. There was no chemist. There was no substance tested saying it was meth. And in our view, the government kind of runs up against the Hall case and the Baggett case that we've cited in the brief from this circuit
I want to question you about those cases. You cite them in your brief and you indicate that the district court struggled with this issue, the possession issue, but you don't have any discussion at all of any of the three cases, Hall, Baggett, and Bryce. And I guess I'd ask you, I think those cases may be distinguishable. How do you think any of them support your argument here?
Well, I think Hall is indistinguishable. It mirrors nearly work on every criterion what we have here. In fact, there were 19 indicted here. There were 18 indicted.
Well, I'm not talking about the number of indictments. I guess I should make myself clear. Let's talk about Hall. The distinction I guess I would like for you to address is that in Hall, as well as I believe the Baggett case, those are both Tenth Circuit cases, I think the distinction is that in those cases you have an intercepted call and you have a defendant speaking about obtaining drugs, and then there's a buy basically that they video, but they don't have what we have here, which is a defendant on the intercepted call saying, clearly indicating he's in possession at that point of two different batches essentially of meth, and that he sold some from the first, which he's saying is of low quality, and that he's hasn't sold any from the second batch that he's obtained, and that it's I think it's Mr. Christner is saying that second batch, go ahead and sell that batch, it's of a higher quality, it's fire, and so on. So my point is, he actually is discussing the fact that he already possessed this methamphetamine. There's no real question about the substance of that call versus what happened in Hall, where he's discussing acquiring it. You see that? Do you think that's a valid distinction? And if not, why not?
I don't. And number one, we contest, these phone calls are coded language. It's normal words that have ascribed some special meaning according to the DEA, agents Billheimer and Becknell.
Mm-hmm.
So off the bat, it's never, and in these cases, you're never going to say, the caller is not going to say, I have 2 pounds of methamphetamine right now. So we contest that he even said that, and we contest what it means, and we raise a proposition of that. If we're going to assume that he is saying that, that Agent Bill Heinrich...
There certainly was testimony explaining the coded words in that particular conversation.
Correct, and we object to that, but to get to your question, if we're assuming that he says that, how do we know that? You know, without waving the flag too much, the burden of proof of beyond a reasonable doubt, it has to mean something. To Mr. Marquez, it means 10 years in federal prison. And he's not charged with making a phone call and talking about possessing meth. He was indicted for actually possessing it. And where's the proof of it? And
why couldn't a reasonable jury, you know, setting aside the code language issue, which I think is legitimate, but why couldn't a legitimate jury infer possession when the defendant admits it?
Well, because people say a lot of things. In the context of this case, and it's important that Mr. Marquez...
They can infer that he was telling the truth.
Well, they can infer that he was just trying to please his cousin's husband. You know, this guy worked at Chuck E. Cheese. He has no interaction with any of the other, no phone calls with any of the 18 co-defendants. He's the cousin of Christner's wife, and Christner's the kingpin. And, you know, you can, when you read the narrative of this case, at least from our view, you know, Marquez was a hanger-on. You can almost see Christner saying, being bugged by his wife, saying, give my cousin something to do. And he says, okay, come drive me this time. Or the most substantial accusation here is Mr. Marquez attempted to negotiate some big meth deal for Mr. Christner.
Well,
he couldn't do it.
There may have been some motivation for him in that conversation to cater to Mr. Christner, and he kind of did when Mr. Christner said, well, if this first batch is of low quality, essentially, go ahead and sell, you know, I'll cover you, go ahead and sell from the next batch because it's good. I mean, and the defendant says, no, you know, nobody's complaining, no problem. I mean, there may have been some motivation for him there, but what would be his motivation in that intercepted phone call that he doesn't know is being intercepted to lie about the fact that he possesses and he's talking about possessing the meth? What would be his motivation to lie at that point about the fact that he has it and discussing the quality of it?
Because it's clear he's trying to be a bigger player than he actually was, and I think he was just puffing, more or less, just lying and trying to make himself seem more important to Mr. Christner than he actually was.
About the quality, you mean? Or about the fact that he possessed it? I guess to me the key is his admission that he's possessed it and that he clearly obtained it from Christner. I guess I don't see your point.
Well, he never says he possesses it. It's if it's part of this ongoing conspiracy, if he's conveying the fact that he has it, that could mean someone else has it. It doesn't mean it's sitting in his... at his feet or in his desk drawer.
Your bottom line is that the legal principle that it's the law of the circuit or that we should recognize is that a mere statement of possession alone is insufficient to prove possession. You need some other piece of corroborating evidence. And it doesn't matter whether it's a phone call or whether it would have been a personal encounter between a, you know, undercover agent and the defendant. I think the same issue would be there unless there's an additional fact that would demonstrate possession. You think our rule should be that's not enough?
There has to be something more, Your Honor. I think that's what Hall and Baggett and the case from the Second Circuit hold. If there's no more questions on that, I'll move on to the second topic I'd like to bring up to the court is the just a straightforward confrontation issue under Crawford, where Agent Billheimer interjects that she interviewed Christner. And remember, Christner was the kingpin. He was arrested. He's actually set up twice. He kind of got away the first time. They found a large amount of cash, but The second time he was caught cold, had meth, and he flipped. The DEA flipped him. And he was debriefed and then had medical issues and passed away before trial, before he could be prosecuted. But before he did, Agent Billheimer stated that she interviewed him and that he confirmed her understanding of what his drug conspiracy was. And the jury heard that. Defense counsel objected on confrontation grounds, and we believe that's clearly reversible error in this case. I think
what harm flowed from that statement?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
How is that harmful to Mr. Marquez?
It's harmful because you have, if you read the trial transcripts, there's probably this much against Mr. Marquez directly. There's this much against Christner. It's all about Christner and how he orchestrated meth distribution in Alamogordo and Las Cruces and all around and into Arizona. So if the DEA agent, Billheimer, is saying, yeah, I talked to this guy, he told me all about it, and everything I'm telling the jury is true, then it makes Christner basically becomes a witness against Marquez without being subject to cross-examination. And the government does what they do in a lot of these cases is they play these snippets of these recordings, and then they ask Agent Billheimer, what does that mean? And then the DEA agent says, well, I know they said they're talking about zebras and they're talking about this other, they're using the English language, but this is what it really means. And so it buttresses her testimony about her interpretation, which we believe is not proper on 701, 702 grounds. But beyond that, it really brings home to the jury that this deceased hierarchy, that the guy at the top, confessed. It's all true.
Defense counsel, then in cross-examination of Agent Billheimer, says, then asks questions and brings out the fact that there was no, Mr. Christner never did implicate Mr. Marquez, his name's not even mentioned. Does that play into the harmless error? I mean, does that lessen the harm by that questioning? I mean, I understand why the questioning occurred, but once it's been opened up, but does that help us reach harmless error? I mean, is it?
Not in our view, Judge. I know that's what the government argued in mm-hmm. its response brief, that this error actually helped Mr. Marquez. Mm-hmm. We believe that is untrue. If defense counsel is asking, well, did he implicate Mr. Marquez? Remember, this is at least a 19-person drug conspiracy. Marquez is down here. It wouldn't be, if Agent Billheimer is debriefing Christner, she probably didn't even ask him about Marquez, because at that time he was just one of the 19 indicted, and he was like on the bottom of the totem pole. In our view, that shouldn't matter. I'm running a little long time. One last issue I'd kind of like to direct the court's attention to is in conspiracy law, this notion of interdependence, and that's an element in this circuit. And when I was drafting this brief and researching this issue, it's a little bit unclear to me what exactly that is. It's a little ambiguous. How is that different? And I know it's articulated in, I think, the Evans case that I cited. So maybe in writing this opinion and addressing that, perhaps the bench and the bar would benefit from explication of what that exactly means. Because in our view, under the facts of this case, you have Marquez is just dealing only with Christner. He doesn't even know the other people. The 40-minute phone call that the government played at the end, it was, It was the rest of the co-conspirators explaining to Marquez what happened. The guy didn't know really anything. So is that interdependence? And obviously in the brief, we believe it's not. And my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. Let's hear from the government next.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Sarah Davenport, and I'm an assistant U.S. attorney in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Counsel. First, I'd like to touch on Judge Moritz's question about Hall and the possession with intent to distribute count. The government doesn't argue that there doesn't need to be any sort of corroboration. Clearly, a statement made by a defendant can't stand on its own. There has to be some corroboration. It doesn't have to be direct evidence. It can be circumstantial evidence, and it's our position that there is sufficient substantial sufficient circumstantial evidence here to confirm and to corroborate that Mr. Marquez did in fact possess methamphetamine with intent to distribute it in March when he was engaged in that phone call with Mr. Christner. And there are subsequent things that not only do the statements themselves, I believe, as Judge Moritz was touching on, corroborate that he actually had meth right then. It's not like the situation in Hall where we have a buy set up and then we have people meeting and there's kind of this presumption that the buy happened and so then they were trying to infer that there was possession because the meeting confirmed.
What is there other than the phone call for what March 16th?
March 16th. In the content of the phone call, Mr. Christner begins by asking Mr. Marquez, "Did you get into that other one already? It's fire." So clearly, Mr. Christner provided it. It's not methamphetamine that he's assuming that somebody else provided. He's talking about the methamphetamine that he provided to Mr.
All right, but what's the corroborating evidence outside of that phone call that is related to that possession on that day by this defendant?
We think when we look in the context of the other phone calls that Mr. Christner was having with other distributors about the quality of methamphetamine that they had, and then his phone call with UM-171, who was a source of supply in Arizona, as they were trying to make right this bad batch that he got, and then as a result, then you actually have methamphetamine. So you know it's not just some bad batch of drugs, but it's actually methamphetamine. It's corroborating what the substance was.
In Baggett, I don't think you're quite getting there. In Baggett, we said the circumstance, if the government doesn't present direct evidence, and this isn't direct evidence of drug possession, its circumstantial evidence must include some testimony linking to an observed substance that a jury could infer to be a narcotic. What do you have here at all linking to an observed substance?
Yes, sure. I'm not sure if it's in Baggett or in...
Well, you don't discuss Baggett and you don't cite that language and no one does, but I'm wondering if you can distinguish that somehow or if we didn't mean what we said or...
Your Honor,
I think you don't have that here.
Okay. And Your Honor, I think that... what we were looking towards is actually the language in Hall that talks about the different, there's a whole inclusive list that's not exclusive. It's, you know, these are some of the things that might corroborate, and one of those is a discussion of the effect of the substance. So the efficacy of the methamphetamine, and you have that language actually in the conversation as they're discussing, okay, is it fire, it's good, or there's no legs to it. It's not working.
So the corroborating evidence, your argument is, can be conversation within that same phone call where the defendant is discussing his possession of it.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. I mean, that is.
Do you have any authority for that?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that's a clear correlation with Hall. I mean, It is the kind of evidence and the kind of discussion, the same quality, you know, talking about how it worked or how it didn't work, and then following up on that, you have other evidence of it actually being methamphetamine. So there was not a seizure. We can't test anything, but all in context, when you look at it in, under the totality of the circumstances, I believe that there was enough to find possession with intent at that time, albeit not a whole lot more than just sufficient. And if there aren't any other questions on that particular issue, I'd like to turn to the Sixth Amendment, which I agree is a big one for us to discuss. The court can find that this was harmless error. And we can't really argue that it wasn't testimonial in any sense of it, or that it didn't violate the confrontation clause. I mean, that it happened. However, really when the court looks at this, you have to look at the weight of the properly admitted evidence and that in comparison to the erroneously admitted hearsay. And when we look at that, really, that's where this absolutely hinges on whether or not the jury believed that Mr. Marquez is the one on the phone. And clearly they did. There was no way for them to find him guilty on any count that they didn't believe he was on the phone. And that was a reasonable conclusion for them to make. And that really hinged, it's all culminates in that April 19th, 2013 set of events. And so on that day, if we look at the calls, and I know the court has the recordings, and then we also supplemented with demonstrative transcripts to help the court. If you look at call 3K, that's when this voice that's using Target Telephone 7, who called, self-identified as Jesse, says, "I got us 2 peas a week, not 3, but it's 2. It's 10. He talks about having tried to do it for a lesser price. In that phone call, he said he and Mr. Christner are talking about where they each are located, when they're going to meet up, and when they're going to go talk to these people that Mr. Marquez has been negotiating with. And the voice that calls himself Jesse says, "I'm at my house on Hoagland." And then they decide to talk later and figure out when they're going to meet up. Within that call, repeatedly, Jesse is saying, "We'll go together. We'll talk to them. We'll go for it." He is an integral part of the conversation that he's agreeing to then pick up Mr. Christner and take Mr. Christner to. He's not saying, "Oh, well, you need to go talk to these people." He's saying, "We're going to do this. We're going to be good. We're in it for this much. They're going to be assuring us 2 a week. And he says, "I'm at my house on Hoagland." So you have a guy named Jesse who lives in a house on Hoagland and who agrees to pick up Mr. Christner. And then a little bit later in the day, there's other stuff going on with Mr. Christner, and he's calling other distributors and trying to collect money and setting up meetings with those people. There's another call with Jesse and Mr. Christner. They talk about the fact that Mr. Christner is on foot. His wife is not allowing him to drive her vehicle, and Mr. Christner himself doesn't have a vehicle. And again, Jesse says, "I will pick you up and we'll go." And then lo and behold, who shows up? A man named Jesse Marquez in a car registered to his mother, Rose Marquez, who lives in a house on Hoagland. And so I think there was sufficient evidence for them to conclude that Agent Becknell identified the right person, not only from his surveillance and the driver's license photos, but also that he still remembered that person in court, and that Jesse that was on the phone is Jesse Marquez who showed up and drove Christner down to Anthony that day.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I don't understand their argument about identity to really relate to this particular issue. It seems to relate to the sufficiency issues, and I understand how you're trying to connect up the identity and how you did for the jury of his voice on the call. I think their point on this issue, the confrontation issue, is that this prosecutor, when he asked the question of Agent Bilheimer about her conversation with this individual who's now deceased, who's the kingpin of all this, and the question was whether he confirmed generally what she had learned from her investigation, and Billheimer said yes. That's a pretty big, it's one word, but it's a pretty big yes, because we've had Agent Billheimer testifying all about these conversations and her in understanding of what those meant. And she reached a couple conclusions about what those conversations meant and what the code words meant and how they kind of fit into this big scheme. And so that one word yes is pretty significant, putting the whole identity issue aside. Could you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe that, and it's probably taking too long to get there, once you identify that Jesse is the voice that appear of the person who then drives Christner that day, then you have 2.5 hours of recorded calls. They listened to 36 phone calls. The jury was in a perfect position to decide, was that Marquez on the phone the entire time? And if it
But Agent Billheimer did more than just say this was his voice. She talked about what these conversations meant in terms of this particular defendant and his involvement. And that's what I'm trying to get you to address. That's the harm, if there's harm.
I understand the court's question now. The properly admitted evidence is so overwhelming that even though, yes, of course, she's confirming, and I was the prosecutor who asked the question.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't really
regret that.
Yeah.
I did. So wouldn't ask it again. But when you look at it in the context, the answer was, when you actually look at the context of what information Mr. Christner provided, it was that he was the head of a drug trafficking organization. He had people that were working for him. It's only by inference and extrapolation that you get to, okay, so therefore what she was saying about Marquez was confirmed also. But he never said Marquez. He said that he was working. And the threshold is that when you compare the prejudicial effect of the inadmissible hearsay that came in with the overwhelming nature of the properly admitted evidence, that it's so inconsequential that it has to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's our argument.
Well, I mean, you got Mr. Christner, who's the head of all of this, who's involved in all of this, who's now deceased, who can't testify and who they can't confront, saying, yep, Agent Billheimer, supposedly, this is, yep, everything you're saying is correct. This is what happened. I confirm it all. Yes, that's damaging for a jury to hear.
Yes, I understand the point.
That's the big picture.
That is the big picture. But when you look at the totality of the rest of the evidence that had come in, the defendant never contested that Mr. Christner was the head of a drug trafficking organization or that he had other people working for him. And that evidence had come in, that was clear. And so when you look at the actual substance of the statement, my question, her answer, and then the further explanation on cross-examination, all he said was, yes, I've been selling, and I've got people working for me in Las Cruces and Alamogordo. And so in the context of the bigger picture of all of the evidence that they had heard, it was so inconsequential, neither I nor Mr. Harrison, the trial counsel, relied on it in closing arguments. And I think that in that respect, this court has upheld confrontation clause violations in other cases where the other evidence was so overwhelming and the statement it really ended up being inconsequential in light of the other things. And in some respects where there were even, I'd like to get to the site, where it's in Edwards, where the prosecutor actually, although the court had given a limiting instruction, the prosecutor relied on it in closing, and even basically it was an identity question off of a 911 call, and the court still said all of the other testimony overwhelms this one statement, and it's not so damaging as to warrant reversal. And it's our position that the court, when you look at the entirety of the evidence that was before the jury, that you should and can find that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
It appeared on the 701 issue, it does appear that Billheimer's testimony went beyond overview type testimony that our cases permit, and you know, quite a few of those statements do seem to really bleed over to expert type testimony about what code language means in these conspiracies. If we think that was expert testimony, what's that do to the evidence in the case?
Yes, John, I see that my time is up. May I answer the question? So we maintain that her testimony was lay testimony, and that in the context of almost all of the questions, what she was asked was, what was important to you in the context of your ongoing investigation and what you were doing and what determinations you were making about what to do next to try and identify sources of supply and figure out what was going on in this drug trafficking organization. Trial counsel never asked or objected to her testimony as expert testimony. He never put the court on notice that it needed to exercise any sort of gatekeeping function with regard to her testimony as coming in as expert testimony. And so it's a plain error standard that we're looking at here. And under that circumstance, there are a couple of times, I believe, in her testimony where she said, I had heard that before, and so it does clearly implicate her training and experience. But for the most part, she was talking about what had happened in this investigation, what her experience was, and her perception of the evidence as she was making decisions as the case agent. So it's our position that even if there was some minor bleed over in that testimony, it's not plain error, and it certainly doesn't implicate his substantial rights in light of the rest.
Thank you, counsel. I think we understand the parties' arguments. Counselor excused, and Ms. Davenport, I do appreciate the candid concessions. Thank you. Case shall be submitted.